Okay, thank you very much. So I will tell you about discovery. We've discovered something, and we think, I'll try to convince you that it's a Higgs boson. And the reason we're not calling it the Higgs boson is because we need to make a few more measurements still. But I'll tell you why I think it's a Higgs boson. So on July 4th of this year, two big experimental collaborations of 3,000 people each announced the discovery of a new particle. And this is the big room at CERN. And half of it was filled with very important people. Those are CERN directors and Nobel laureates and Peter Higgs. And the upper half is summer students who and there wasn't a lot of in between. You had to camp out basically all night if you wanted to get a seat. It was probably worth it, but I was sleeping. Okay, so here's an overview of my talk. So I'll tell you a little bit about what is the Higgs boson. Matt Strassler already gave a talk, as Eric was saying, on the theoretical aspects. So it'll be very short. I'll spend most of my time discussing the LHC and the Atlas detector and try to explain how these experiments work so that you can understand what's the experimental evidence for this this Higgs boson. Okay, and I'll try to give you an overview of the three channels that are responsible for the observation. So the Higgs can decay to many particles, but the observation was driven by three channels. And in the remaining time, I'll tell you about discovering, you know, this new particle with 3,000 friends and how results are approved and how we fight or and come to some consensus about the title of a paper, etc. Okay, so just a quick reminder of what the standard model is about. It has 12 matter particles, or 12 fermions, that are spin 1/2, got 6 quarks and 6 leptons. So the matter around us is made up of this first generation here, up and down quarks that make up protons and neutrons and the electron. And then we have families with particles that are heavier, and the heaviest of all is a top quark. So the top quark is as heavy as 175 protons, roughly. So these particles interact through three forces. The standard model doesn't deal with gravity, so I'll discuss three forces. One of them you know very well, the electromagnetic force. And this force is mediated by particles, or bosons, spin 1 particles. And so for the electromagnetic force, the mediator is a photon. For the strong force that binds the quarks together, we have 8 of them, 8 gluons. And then there's the weak force. And this is the interesting one. We'll see on the next slide. And these bosons are massive. And I've given talks like, I mean, this slide probably you've seen before. I've shown it for 20 years, and there was always, you know, one missing, a Higgs boson. But now I think we have one. We have something that looks like a spin zero particle. And this is an important ingredient to make the standard model work. Okay, so we have a very successful theory of electromagnetism, a quantum theory, which was developed at the end of the 40s. And in this theory, so the picture is that particles exchange a virtual photon. And for this to work, it requires that the mediator, the photon, have no mass. And that's the case. The weak force, however, has massive bosons. So what does the weak force do? Charge current, so a W boson, for instance, can change one quark into another quark. Here it changes the d quark of a neutron into an up quark, and so you make a proton, and this is like beta decay, essentially. Now, these massive particles, the fact that they're massive presented a problem, so you couldn't do the same thing as you did for quantum electrodynamics. And so the theory is said to be non-renormalizable, so you can't really make sense of the infinities that come out. And so that was the theoretical problem that Higgs and others solved. So how to give mass to these particles here and make the theory renormalizable? So it's Higgs and others. There are some condensed matter physicists in the list that I have here. And maybe if I have time, I'll tell you why this is related to condensed matter physics. So maybe two quick slides on what the Higgs is in a nutshell. So in this picture where you have this Higgs field and the Higgs boson, so particles are subject to a new kind of force, and the strength of this interaction, of this new force, with a given particle determines its mass. So the top quark is very heavy, and so the Higgs really likes the top quark. And particles that are light, like the electron or neutrinos, doesn't interact strongly at all. So the force associated with this, this force is not associated with a vector field, I should say, like the electromagnetic field. So an electromagnetic field points in a direction, so it's a vector. Vector field, it's a scalar field, right? So the mass of an electron doesn't depend on the direction. So scalar fields, it's simpler. If you understand electromagnetism, this is a simple field. And so the quantized waves of the electromagnetic field are photons, then the quantized waves of this new field are Higgs bosons. Okay, and unlike, so this is an important piece, is that unlike the electromagnetic field, this field is on everywhere in space. So you can go very far, you know, between galaxies or whatever. This field is on. It has the same value as it does in this room. And we'll use a little V to set the value of this field. We'll come back to that later. And so that means that the physical vacuum is not empty. And so we've learned something about the vacuum. It has this field everywhere. Higgs bosons, or Higgs field waves, they're oscillations, really, in the properties of this physical vacuum. Okay? And the value of the field picked by nature, this V, determines the physics and also the chemistry of the universe we live in. Okay, if you change this V, this field, by 10%, that the masses of the electron, you know, the quarks goes up by 10%. So you change the mass of the electron and you change chemistry, that's for sure. Maybe just one little parenthesis here is that most of the mass around us, you know, from in this desk or your body, comes from the protons and the neutrons. And the mass of protons is not determined by the mass of the quarks. 90% of the mass of a proton is just from the interactions of the gluons and the quarks. And so most of the mass is just essentially energy. But still, that's what we mean by mass in particle physics, like a fundamental mass. So how do we test this theory? So how do we go about testing that there's such a thing as a Higgs field that interacts with massive particles? We need to produce excitations of that field, that is the Higgs boson, and then we need to measure how they interact with massive particles. Okay, and producing the Higgs bosons and showing that what you observe is indeed a Higgs boson is quite difficult. One reason is that the Higgs boson is very heavy, has about the mass of 125 protons. So you need a lot of energy to get that excitation. The Higgs boson is also produced very rarely, so only a small fraction of the events that you produced will give you a Higgs boson. So you need many, many candidates. So your accelerator needs to run at high energy, but very importantly, it needs to produce many, many collisions. Okay, so for some of the, I'll show you some pictures of candidate Higgs decays, and what you'll see happens once every 10 to the 13. It's very rare. Okay, so the basic principle of how we do the physics essentially goes back to Rutherford's experiment. So you take some particle and you shoot it at a target and you look at what comes out, the angle and the energy or momentum of what comes out. Okay, for our accelerator runs at high energy, and the reason is that if you want to resolve a structure that's very, very small, you need high momentum. Right? If you have a microscope, an optical microscope, there's a limit to what you can see because it's limited by the wavelength of light. If you want to see something smaller, you'll need to use X-rays, and something smaller still, higher momentum photons. You can do the same thing with particles. Okay, particles, you can associate a wavelength to them. And so if you go to very high energy, it allows you to shrink that lambda, that wavelength, down and probe very, very, very small things. Okay, so this is the Large Hadron Collider. It's a big, 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 big machine. It's 27 kilometers around, and it collides protons on protons at the center of mass energy of 7 TeV. TeV is 10 to the 12 electron volts, and an electron volt is the energy of the photons, roughly, that we see right now. Okay, so that's a million times higher than the energy of processes in the sun, inside the sun. And we do these collisions every 50 nanoseconds. Okay, so we inject protons, and they go, for all practical purposes, they're going at the speed of light, you know, minus epsilon. So they do 11,000 turns a second one way, 11,000 turns a second the other way, and we collide them 20 million times a second. And to set the scale, I don't know if you can see well, but this is the Geneva airport, and this is the lake and the Alps. So with this, we produce right now up to almost a billion collisions per second. And the machine will be shut down in the next few months for a period of about 2 years so that we can reach higher energies, going to almost doubling the energy. Okay, the experiments are about 100 meters below ground. I'll show you some nice pictures of the tunnel. So this is some of our group at CERN. This is Professor Teuscher. It's not with us right now. And you have some images of the tunnel. So these are big dipole magnets that are designed to create a magnetic field of 8 Tesla. And they're 12 meters long, and there are almost 1,300 of them. And so during our long shutdown, they're going to disconnect all of them and fix some connections that will allow us to go to higher energies. But it's going to take a while, you can imagine. This is the magnets run at 1.8 Kelvin. And so it's a gigantic cryogenic plant, in fact. All of this is cooled over 27 kilometers. Okay, the Atlas collaboration is a really big collaboration, 3,000 people. When I joined CDF, which was an experiment in Chicago, we were 350, and I thought that was big, but this is really big. So there are 174 institutions in 38 countries, and people knew that we were building this Large Hadron Colliders at the end of the 80s, and they knew that there would be over 2,000 people collaborating around the world. And so one important project, early project, was to facilitate the communication of all these physicists around the world. And that was the proposal by a CERN scientist. And probably many of you know the answer. So the answer was the World Wide Web. And I'm going to milk this for the next 20 years. I don't care if you know. So the Atlas detector is a big thing, too. It's about 45 meters long, 25 meters high, and those are people to set the scale. It has over 100 million electronic channels, and so we're recording signals from 100 million channels, and we're essentially taking pictures, you know, 20 million pictures with these 100 million channels. So it's a big, it's like a big camera, if you will, that's taking pictures of collisions. So what we're trying to do with this big thing is do two things: measure the momentum of particles and measure their energy. So to measure the momentum, we have magnetic spectrometers. So we have big magnets that are designed to bend particles. And so we measure how much they bend. That will tell us about the momentum. And the spectrometers are in the center. We have the inner detector here. And the big thing, most of what you see is actually another big spectrometer, the muon spectrometer. And we'll take a more detailed look at that in a second. Another thing that we try to measure is the energy of the particles. And so for that, we use calorimeters. So for the calorimeters, what they do is we use some very dense material, could be lead, and we try to stop the particles that are coming and measure their energy. I'll show you a picture of how we do that in a minute. So this big camera that's taking 20 million snapshots a minute generates a lot of data. In fact, if you took all of the data that's coming out, it would fill 100,000 CDs per second. And so you would create a stack of CDs that are 150 meters high every second, and you would reach the moon and back twice a year. And the data rate is also equivalent to 50 billion telephone calls at the same time. So Atlas actually will take a fraction of those data. We can't afford to 100,000 CDs per second. So what we end up with is actually 27 CDs per minute, which is much smaller, but it's still a lot. And so we have a system that has to make decisions. There's a collision, and we look at some of the channels and decide, is this potentially interesting, this collision? And if it is, then we pass it to another level, which is a bit, you know, less coarse. And then we ask the question, is this really interesting? And if the answer is yes, then we do full reconstruction, and we ask the question again, do we really want to keep it? And if the answer is yes, then we write it out. So we take about 400 events per second at the end of the day. Now, the data are reconstructed and analyzed in a worldwide computing grid that has over 100,000 processors and 100 petabytes. And so the University of Toronto is involved in that computing grid. We have a fantastic facility here at U of T, for those who don't know, with amazing staff. And it includes this big 30,000 processor general purpose cluster. And we've used it this summer. It was very, very useful. And our own Dick Peltier is the director of SINET. So here's the Atlas detector without the calorimeter. There's somebody here and somebody working. And what you're seeing right now is just the muon spectrometer. So these are big magnets that are generating a toroidal field. So the field goes around like this. And I'm going to show you a picture with the calorimeter and me in it. And that was maybe five years ago. The detector was open. And as I was discussing with Eric, it's very impressive to see this. So we're going to open this. And if you're in Switzerland, you should come and down and try to see. Send me an email. it's like Dr. Evil's lair. And So I got this in the picture because that was my PhD project. So I was, at the time, none of this existed. I was doing computer simulations, trying to figure out how to build this calorimeter and changing the thicknesses of the plates and things like that. And the design consideration, in fact, most of the design considerations for all of these systems was a particular Higgs channel. Okay, and what we wanted to do is make sure that we could find the Higgs when some particles are going in the forward direction. So this is a Canadian contribution. And a part that you don't see, which is a Toronto contribution, is inside the forward calorimeter. So that's like my baby. But I didn't build it on it. I went away for 10 years to Chicago, where I did real measurements, and then came back, and people had dug a gigantic hole in the ground, built the thing. That's why I was smiling. Okay, so let's take a look at the inner tracker. So this is what's closest to the collision. And you want to measure the particles that are going through. So the collision happens here. Particles fly out. And so this detector is built up of many, I mean, you can see some paddles here, silicon wafers. And on those wafers, you can see something that's blown up here. It's basically a PN junction. Here it shows, you know, it's of order a few hundred micrometers. So when a particle goes through, it will ionize the silicon, produce electrons and holes, and then you can collect the electrons. And you can have little pixels or strips that allow you to pinpoint where the particle went through. And when you put many of those layers everywhere, you can reconstruct the track of a particle that's going through the detector, and we can measure the position to within a hair. We're roughly 20 microns. It's very, very precise. There's another detector technology, for instance, in that part here, and I'll show you some animation of a similar technology in a muon system. But this is something you may be familiar with. It's like drift tubes or a Geiger counter or straws, where you have a tube, and inside you have a wire, and you apply a difference of potential, and there's a gas here that can be ionized. So when the particle goes through, it ionizes the gas, and you can collect a signal on the anode. And if you have many of those straws, then you can sort of reconstruct, you know, this straw was hit, this one was hit, this one was hit, and you reconstruct a trajectory. And here are some pictures of this super silicon tracker being assembled. And these are the drift tubes, or the straws that I was describing. So this is inserted inside here. And this, these two things then go into, this is a solenoid magnet that generates a field of 2 tesla that will bend the charged particles that we detect with this. So this is a truck carrying one of the 8 big magnets that we were looking at. And I'll show you these magnets. So this is what we were looking at before. It's a magnet arriving at the lab. And then it's quite complicated, actually, to fit these things down. You need to go down 100 meters, and you can't bump against anything. Lots of things are fragile. And so it's a very impressive choreography to get this done. What you see here is the electromagnetic calorimeter. We'll take a close look in a second. But this calorimeter is immersed in liquid argon. So this is active medium where when a charged particle goes through, it will ionize the liquid argon and will collect some charge. And so since liquid argon needs to be at 80 Kelvin or so, it goes in a big cryostat, and that's what you see. Okay, and this is the tracker being inserted inside the calorimeter. Okay, so this is what a collision could look like. So the beams are going through the screen right now. And so when the two protons hit, a bunch of particles come out, and then we try to measure things. Now, the person standing here is just to set the scale, because if you stood there, you would die. And what we're going to look at is just a wedge here. I want to explain to you how we do the measurements. So suppose I've got an electron. So this is an electron here. So in the first part here, it's in a magnetic field. So since the electron is a charged particle, it's going to bend. How much it bends will determine its momentum. And then it's going to hit the calorimeter, and then we're going to stop it. It's a very dense lead calorimeter. And then we'll collect the energy. If you have a photon, well, the photon is not a charged particle, so we won't see it in the tracker. But then when it hits the lead, then it will stop and we'll measure its energy. Particles like the proton or the neutron, they need a larger calorimeter to contain their shower because they're much bigger. So that shower can start in the EM calorimeter, but we need to catch it with a hadronic calorimeter. And the muons. Muons, interestingly, can go through pretty much all the calorimeters without interacting, which is why we have this muon spectrometer outside, because we can measure their momentum outside. When it reaches that point, we know it's a muon, so that's good. Particles like neutrinos, they will go through everything, and we won't see them at all. Right? So a neutrino calorimeter, you would need not a few meters of lead, but you would need light years of lead, which is too expensive even for us. Okay, so we're going to look now at the EM calorimeter, which is this part here. So this is the hadron calorimeter we were looking at, and this is the EM calorimeter. And okay, we're going to zoom in on that part. So this calorimeter has a very interesting geometry, a very interesting structure. It's built like an accordion of sheets of lead and stainless steel. You're going to see taken apart. Okay, so these are sheets of lead. And in between, so these are the absorbers. In between, you have this blue thing is liquid argon, the active medium. Okay, so when particles go through, they ionize this. And underneath that, we have electrodes that are segmented. So we know that, you know, where we collect the charge. That will determine where the particle went. And so when you, we're going to look at an electron going through, starting a shower. So you start with one particle, and then it hits the lead, and then it can produce a photon. That photon can then continue and interact and produce an electron and a positron, and the electron will emit the photon, et cetera, et cetera. So this process makes a big shower like this. So there might be 100,000 particles in here. And we can reconstruct the direction also of the particles. We're going to zoom in and look at what happens inside the calorimeter. So you have your little electron that hits the subsorber layer, and then, whoops, more particles come out, and they're leaving charges behind. and we collect those charges. Okay, and where those charges are collected gives us some position information. Okay, so that's for the calorimeter. I'm focusing on this calorimeter because it's quite important for the discoveries that I'll mention later. Now we're going to take a look at the muon system. So this is the thing that's outside of the calorimeters. Okay, so inside the magnets, there are many different chambers that are used to make measurements of the particles that are going through. And this illustrates the various layers of chambers. And so by making many measurements over quite a bit of space, you can determine the curvature of the track. Now we're going to look at one chamber. And you see that it's one of those drift tubes. So inside of this, you've got a gas. And this this wire is charged, right? And so as a particle goes through, it ionizes the gas, and you collect the signal. And so you can link all of the hits like this to produce a segment. The particle continues and hits the other tubes. And so then we have one segment here. And with the other chambers, you'll have another segment. And it's in the magnetic field, so we'll be able to see how much it bends and make a momentum measurement this way. Okay, so how do we measure particle masses? Because this is one of the ways that we measured the Higgs. We were looking for a bump in some mass spectrum. So if you have a short-lived particle that decays into two long-lived particles, so say two electrons, okay? If you've done a little bit of special relativity, and here I apologize for using C equals 1, but we always do that, you can determine the mass if you've got the energy and the momentum. Okay? So we've got calorimeters for the energy, we've got trackers for the momentum. Okay, and if this particle decays to these, say this electron and this anti-electron, I need to measure the energy and then the momentum components of one electron and the same thing for the others, and I just add them together and I get one vector like this, and then I can obtain the mass. So that's the basic idea. Okay, so another example, Z boson going to one muon and another muon. And here, the mass of the muons is really small compared to this very heavy particle. It's about 90 protons in terms of mass. Okay, and if you do that, then what you can do is just measure the angle between the two particles and their momenta. And so this formula here can be simplified. So you measure the angle, you have the momenta, and you have the mass. Okay, so here's an example of what I just described, the Z boson decaying to muons. So you see one track going through the muon system up here, and you see, I don't know if you can see it, but the little straws that we saw before, or groups of three straws, are lit up. And so the momentum is measured in this spectrometer, but also inside, and then the other muon went there. You can measure the angle between the two, and we have the momentum from the spectrometer, and we can calculate a mass. So this is not too far away from the average accepted mass for the Z boson, which is 91 GeV. Okay, so if you look at many muons that have high momentum, what you'll see is this beautiful peak in the mass distribution. So this is 90 GeV, about 90 protons. You see this bump, this nice resonance. And this can be done by any student, undergrad, even high school students. It's not that hard, just using the math that I showed you before. You can also look at lower energies and you'll see other resonances, other particles that we know about. Okay, so that's the basic idea. It's actually a bit complicated because, as I told you, we're colliding a lot. So we have between 300 and 80 million collisions a second. So every time little bunches of protons cross, we get between 15 and 35 collisions these days. And here's an example of 25 collisions. So we've reconstructed 25 collisions, and those are interaction vertices. And out of that, one of them, you know, two muons come out, and that's also like a Z candidate. But this is what we have to deal with. All these other collisions are like parasites. They complicate the reconstruction of the event. Okay, so now I'll switch to the Higgs and how it's produced and how it decays. But I'll just focus on this thing here. So this is the dominant, we believe, in the standard model at least, the dominant production mechanism for the Higgs. So the protons are made up of quarks and gluons. Quarks have, the up and down quarks of the proton are not massive at all, and gluons are massless. And so the Higgs doesn't really it doesn't couple much to those particles. However, the top quark is very heavy, and it feels the strong force. And so you are allowed to draw this loop here where the top quark couples to the Higgs because it's heavy, but also to the gluons. So if we saw the Higgs this summer, this is probably how it was produced most of the time. But we're also looking at other production mechanisms. But the message here is that if we've seen the Higgs, we've probably measured also its coupling to the top quark. One interesting thing is how the Higgs decays. And the good thing about the standard model is it's very predictive. The only parameter we didn't have is the Higgs mass. But once you have the Higgs mass, you know pretty much how everything should behave. Okay, just to remind you, this V is the value of the field, which can be determined in the undergrad labs or the advanced labs. The Higgs mass is more complicated. So if you look at the graphs here, they tell you how often the Higgs decays to a certain pair of particles. And maybe we can focus on this one in particular. So this is where we found evidence that there's a Higgs boson. And this tells you how often it should decay to a pair of B and B bar quarks. It's a fraction. And then tau leptons, how often it's going to go to WW and ZZ. Okay, so if it's the standard model Higgs boson, we should hit those targets, basically, all of them. It's a good thing that the Higgs is here at some level, because we have many, many things to measure. Had it been heavier, around 180, we would have only been able to measure the WW and ZZ couplings, not the others. Okay, so before the LHC turned on, there were other accelerators that had been looking for it. So the Large Electron Positron Collider that was in the same tunnel didn't find it, but they went up to 115 GeV. The accelerator in Chicago, where I used to work, took out a bit of space here between 160 and 180. And if you assume that the standard model is correct, you can, through other measurements, sort of infer what's the mass of the Higgs. And this is what you see here. So it's a fit. So the fit prefers a value around 100 GeV, which is excluded. But within one sigma, you can go out to 125 and maybe 70. And within two sigma, you go out to 160 maybe. So before we started, we knew that, you know, if the standard model Higgs was there, it had to be probably in this region. Okay, and on this plot, what you see, the line at 1 tells you whether we're excluding a Higgs at that mass. So every time you see the line go below, it means that we've excluded the Higgs at that mass with a confidence level of 95%. We're pretty sure that it's not there. So in 2010, we did not have any sensitivity. This is because we're above 1 everywhere. But by the summer of 2011, then we were really in the business of Higgs physics. We were excluding pretty big chunks of the mass, potential mass of the Higgs. And this is a complicated plot that just to show you that we are looking in many different decay channels and everywhere over the whole range. In the low mass range, you see that three channels dominate, these three, the Higgs decaying to two photons, to two Ws, and to two Zs, and this is where we did the observation. So at the end of 2011, we had excluded almost all the range out to 500 GeV and down to here, and we were having trouble excluding that region. The reason we were having trouble excluding that region is we had a bump there. We had an excess of events that corresponded to 3.5 sigma. So I need to explain it to Paul. Who is it? So this, you can convert this sigma in terms of a probability, and you have it here. Okay, so 3 sigma is basically one chance in 1,000 that what we observe could be a background fluctuation. So that's pretty, it's pretty small. On the other hand, we were looking at many channels everywhere. So we were looking in many places. So if you look at the 1,000 places, one of them is going to fluctuate, right? And so we have a trials factor of a look elsewhere effect. When you take that into account, what we saw at the end of 2011 was about 2 sigma. So, you know, this, the probability here is like, you know, we've got a 5% chance that this was a background fluctuation, which isn't that big. Okay. So going into 2012, we knew that we were either going to find the Higgs or exclude it. And so I've taught this standard model course, and I've been telling my students, some of them are here, I was hoping that we would exclude it so I wouldn't need to teach it. And now it looks like I need to teach it. Okay, so there are 3 channels where we saw the Higgs, essentially. One of them is ZZ going to 4 leptons. And so the production mechanism I mentioned before, so this is going through a top quark, and then the Higgs, you know, goes to Z and Z. So you're measuring the coupling of the Higgs to ZZ. This is a very nice final state because all you need to do is take 4 vectors instead of the 2, right, and reconstruct them, and you expect to see a mass bump. Okay, and the other thing you can do is, since these are 2 Z bosons, you can reconstruct a Z mass and another Z mass. And so that helps. So this is a pretty clean channel, but it's quite rare. So the, you know, getting the 4 muons that you saw before, like I said, is once every 10 to the 13 collisions. So this is what the 2 experiments saw. So this is CMS, our competitors. They see this hint of this bump here around 125, and there's another bump here, also at 125. This is ATLAS, this is CMS. And here's a picture of such an event. So you've got the 4 muons here, so these are the rare events that I was talking about, with the muon chambers lighting up. And here's another event where you have 2 muons and 2 electrons. So the 2 electrons are stopped in the calorimeter, and this is the energy that you see from the electrons. So the other important channel is Higgs going to 2 photons. The photons are massless, so they don't couple to the Higgs. However, the Higgs really likes W bosons, and the W bosons are charged, and so they can emit photons. So it has to go through this loop. You can also put a top quark here because the top quark is charged. Okay, so this is another very good channel because you reconstruct the 2 photons, and you're also looking for a mass bump here. And the M calorimeter that we looked at was really designed for that channel, this channel in mind, to really reconstruct it well. So we have very good mass resolution. And what you're looking for is just a bump on top of a background. So you don't necessarily need to understand your background that well. You just look at the sidebands, and then you look for a bump. Okay, the challenge is that the background, although it's in sidebands, it's pretty large. So the signal, you know, you can consider this arbitrary units, but it's 0.04. And just getting 2 high-energy photons out is 1,000 times greater. And then you have this background, so 1 photon, and this could be a quark that fragments in such a way that it gives you something that looks like a photon or a pi zero. So a pi zero is a hadron that decays to 2 photons. And the calorimeter is designed to see these things. So when you have a pi zero that's highly boosted, high momentum, the 2 photons will be very, very close to each other. And what you can see in the calorimeter here is 2 clusters. So that's a hint that it's indeed a pi zero, whereas a real photon would look more like this, just 1 cluster. Okay, so we need to beat down this enormous background down to, if we want to see anything. And here are the bumps that we saw in this mass spectrum. This is for CMS, and this is for ATLAS. It's a bit more complicated than this because this spectrum is split up into many categories, up to 10, where you have excellent, you know, high quality photons in the best regions of your calorimeter to so-so photons in not so good regions of your calorimeter, where the background is not so nice. And you combine statistically all those things. And so we don't see what the fit does, but here we try to give you a glimpse of what the fit does by weighting the events in terms of their signal to background ratio. So those two bumps, again, happen to line up at around 125. Okay. Now, the last channel that I'll discuss has neutrinos in it. And so how do we measure a particle that does not interact? So we use conservation of momentum. So when the two quarks or the two protons collide, a bunch of particles come out, and the momentum of all those particles should add up to zero within the resolution of the detector. Okay, so if we have one of them is a neutrino, it's going to look like this. So there's going to be a momentum imbalance, and you can infer that the neutrino probably went there. And so you can do something, even if you don't detect the neutrino. So the third channel, so this is the one that I was working on, is harder because you have two neutrinos. So you cannot do this nice reconstruction of all the all the particles and look for a mass bump. And the other challenge for this final state is it has many backgrounds, like 10 backgrounds or so that you need to understand very well. However, the Higgs decays more often to these particles. So for going to gamma, it happens only once every 500 times. It's very rare, but this happens quite often. So it's a pretty powerful channel. So what we do for the reconstruction is we do the best we can. We have this quantity called the transverse mass. We attempt to put the two neutrinos into one vector, and so we don't get a nice mass resolution. But this is what we saw. So this, the blue here is our background prediction, and we saw this bump also. So when you put everything together, this is what ATLAS saw. So this is this probability that what we saw when we combine everything is a background-only fluctuation, and it's down to 10 to the minus 9. So that's 6 sigma. And our competitors saw something different, very close to 5 sigma, which is also very small. Okay, and our psychological thresholds are in our field is you need to see something at 5 sigma to claim a discovery or an observation. So so we published this in Physics Letters B, and I'm going to tell you in the minutes that I have left how we do that, how it went about. Okay, so first of all, how do we publish and approve results? Okay, so the first thing is if you're working on some analysis, and the analysis is mature, then an editorial board will be appointed for you, and that ed board will review the analysis and also the material that's to be made public, either plots or if it's the paper, the text and everything. Sometimes, so we don't get biased, we blind the signal region. So in our analysis, for instance, we did not look at where we expected the signal to be, but we look at the sidebands or other control regions to make sure that everything is okay. So if your analysis is blinded, you need to go to a physics group with an audience that's maybe could be as large as the room here, where you convince your colleagues that you can look at the blinded results, that you understand your backgrounds. If you don't convince them, you need to work some more. Okay? And after you've done that, you've got permission to look at the signal region, you need to come back and show them, you know, that there are no bugs and things make sense. So for each of these approvals, you need detailed documentation on the analysis, and you need to provide that in advance. So this can be 20 pages for some analyses. For the analysis that I was working on, it was 400. And this was produced over just a few weeks. The analysis team can be two people, you know, a postdoc, a student, a faculty, or 140 in the case of the analysis I worked on. So once an analysis is approved by the physics group, then you can prepare a paper. And then the ed board needs to say that the draft is okay. So then the draft is circulated to your 3,000 friends, and they have 1 week to comment and send comments, right? And so you need to address all of the comments. And your ed board needs to say that the answers are okay. So after a week, you give a presentation where you say, these were the important comments, here are our answers, can we proceed? So this is in a presentation. If there are no issues, then you're allowed to circulate another draft. So you send it out again to your 3,000 friends, and they have another chance to comment. So after that, you have a public reading where you discuss the comments you got in the second pass. And if there are no issues, you're not done. Then the publication chair will read it, and the spokesperson or some deputy will also read it, and then the paper can go out. So, you know, dealing with the paper referees is really easy compared to all this. So I'm going to tell you about the observation. So at that time, I was at CERN, and I was working on this analysis. And like I said, we knew that we were going to probably find something. We didn't know exactly when, or we could exclude. We're not sure. But the accelerator started at the beginning of April, and it was scheduled to stop for a couple of weeks in mid-June. And so what we had decided is we would take data until June 15th, and we would show up at our big particle physics conference on July 4th. Now, this is not a lot of time, you know, to calibrate this gigantic experiment and analyze the data if you've got a complicated analysis. So we basically worked nonstop, and when I mean nonstop, it's nonstop. In June, you got people around the world, so it's around the clock. It doesn't stop. To validate our simulation samples as they were being made. And sometimes you find a bug and you want it done quickly, so we used Cynet, for instance, for some critical samples. And by the time we reached June 25th, we were happy. We had all our simulation samples. Everything looked pretty good. And so we sent the documentation in the 400 pages and said, we're ready to unblind. Now, the problem was that in the timeline that you saw, it's kind of too late for the conference by that time. So people were discussing, do we fast-track it? It's possible to do that. And so it was kind of a heated exchange because many people wanted it in. Other people didn't want it in because WW is a complicated analysis. And they thought we need to take our time and take our 2 weeks to really look at it. So the decision was made that we would go to the conference without the result, but it would go in the paper at the end of July that I'll discuss in a second. But we got the go-ahead, though, to look. So on the 27th, we did look. And that we were really nervous. I was nervous because we knew we had a strong signal in gamma, gamma, and ZZ, but this was a powerful channel, so it could ruin our observation or the paper or the title of the paper. And so so it took about just 1 hour to unblind the results, and a couple of us, me and somebody else, we just took a quick look at about 200 plots just to see, is there a bug, and everything looked great. And then we saw this bump. So I was really, really excited. I don't think I'll ever go through this again, unfortunately, hopefully. And it's a special date. I don't know if you recognize this, but this is the time machine of Doc Brown. And he set the date to June 27th. So the DeLorean time machine. So the results were consistent with the other channels. And in fact, everything looked good. So we approved normal procedure, the analysis on the 2nd and the 4th of July as the announcement was made. But we knew we had it in the bag, basically. We had a strong signal. So for the paper, so on the 5th of July, we started work on the paper. And so for the paper, there was lots of discussion too. So it was decided that the two collaborations would publish in the same journal at the end of the month, on the 31st, at the same time, 2 p.m. So no collaboration, discovers it first. But we sent it 2 minutes before. So the way we wrote the paper, five people wrote the paper. I wrote one of the sections, the W section. So there was one person that wrote WW, one ZZ, one gamma gamma, one the statistics, and one person who spoke English. There was one French-Canadian, a Greek guy, and a Japanese colleague, and one editor to put everything, you know, together. And there was quite a bit of discussion as to what kind of paper we should write and where we should send it. When you have this paper, interestingly, the journals call you. They want it. And no page limitations. They're all lifted. And people said, you know, this is an important paper. It should be readable by a scientist anywhere. And on the other side, people said, we need to explain technically how we did the measurement and why we believe, you know, it's true. And finally, the two collaborations agreed. And what we essentially wrote were 20-page letters. Okay, so each channel is basically a PRL in itself. But that was kind of an adventure, because we had 1 week to write all of this, and then you need to deal with your 3,000 friends. And that was painful. So for the first draft, we got 60 sets of comments, and some of them had 100 comments, some had 5. I'll say it's over 1,000 comments. They all need to be answered. And we're struggling for time here. And so when we get comments, you know, we would basically write answers. Some of the comments are easy to answer. It's a typo. In fact, if you make a typo, you know, you'll know it. 60 people will tell you. And one thing I did also, I split a paragraph just accidentally. It was a one-sentence paragraph. And then people say you can't write in English, or you're not James Joyce, so you can't do that. So we dealt with that. The second draft has 90 sets of comments. So when, again, over, you know, a period of 48 hours, that's all you do, day and night. And then once we were done with that, there was an iteration with our publication chair and a final iteration with our spokesperson. And she made the last call on, you know, what went in the paper. And then we submitted it at the end of July, and the comments from the referee were minor. In my sections, there were none, so I stayed on vacation. And then it was published on the 29th of August. Okay, so in the last minute, so the next step is what have we found exactly? It really looks like the Higgs, but we don't know if it's the Higgs. So what we want to see here, so these are the uncertainties on the measurement. So one represents the standard model. So what we would like to see is all these things aligning to one, if it's a standard model Higgs. And now we're going to shrink the uncertainties everywhere. Okay? And so it's going to be kind of interesting. This one is a little high. It may come down, or it may stay there. If it stays there, then that's going to be pretty exciting. But that you will know in the next weeks or months. So we'll release some results in the next few weeks, and then later this year by the end of February with a full data set. Okay, so just to conclude quickly, maybe I'll leave it here because I see I'm a little bit over time, and these I've already said. So thank you.